a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite.
The police released their only suspect in the mass murder of film star Sharon Tate and four others.
Late last night, another bizarre murder in Los Angeles, the second in 2 days. The owner of a small supermarket chain found in his home, his head covered by a white hood, a meat fork stuck in his chest. His wife, 38-year-old Mrs. Lino LaBianca, found in the bedroom dead, her back brutally cut by a whip.
He's inside, two bodies outside.
They came and went, and the number varied from 20 to 30. Police said they were a pseudo-religious cult. People who worked on the ranch said they were heavy users of drugs.
Were lurid. The movie actress was Sharon Tate, 26. The others were a male hairdresser, the heiress to a coffee fortune, a writer, and a boy just out of high school.
A wandering band of members of a so-called religious cult with a leader they call Jesus has had three of its followers arrested in the investigation of the murder of Sharon Tate and six others. Those arrested are two women and one man, and the Los Angeles police said they would ask murder indictments against several others. Five women are being held as material witnesses.
They called themselves the family.
Los Angeles has had another multiple murder. Last night, a middle-aged couple was stabbed to death in a case that has striking similarities to the mass murder Saturday of actress Sharon Tate and four friends.
We're taking dope and stealing cars and they just sit around all day and sleep. And that's about it. And went around collecting garbage and had that for dinner and went to the store once in a while. And that was about it. They just slept and got loaded.
People who lived with Manson on the ranch and in the desert denied that they were a violent group. They called themselves the family.
Who was playing? That's what the whole thing is, that we were doing out there was playing. You know.
Well, what kind of guy was Charlie?
He's a good person. Very good person. He's got a lot of peace.
Was he out there all the time?
I don't even know. You know, he'd take off over mountains and just like a deer. And he just wandered around.
In a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite.
On his body, the word war had been carved in the chest. Then, with blood, the killer had scrawled on the refrigerator door the words, death to pigs.
Hello, and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling author Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our fifth look into Charles Manson and his family. If you are enjoying the Deathcast, please consider going to your favorite podcast platform, subscribing, sharing on social media, and leaving a 5-star review. Speaking of 5-stars reviews, we have a new one from Benji the Intern. The Deathcast is a great crime podcast, which I've just stumbled upon. It is hosted by best-selling author Ian Totten. Ian's research is amazing. I am currently listening to the 14-episode podcast on Jimmy Savile, and wow, Jimmy had some issues, to say the least. Not for young ears, however, if you enjoy true crime, you will enjoy the Deathcast. Thank you, Benji the Intern. As always, I have my normal plugs if you would like to follow me on social media. Yeah, that would be YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, MeWe, just search for Ian Totten, author, or The Deathcast. You can also find me on Twitter and Truth Media under Corpse Creek. If you would like to sign up for the show's mailing list or drop me a line, let me know what you thought of a particular series, or just say hello. You can go to CorpseCreekPublishing.com, click on the sign up button or the contact us tab. If you're interested in helping to support the show, while at CorpseCreekPublishing.com, you can click on the donate button, buy me a cup of coffee or a pack of smokes. If you really want to help support the show, you can go to tinyurl.com/DC Patreon. For as little as $2 a month, you can become a patron of this show, get a weekly shout out, as well as help with the production costs of the show. If you're interested in finding any of my novels, you can go to tinyurl.com/totten-books. I'm going to take you to an Amazon link. And that is it for the plugs this week. Alright, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair, kick back, relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last week, Manson and his followers were bouncing around the Bay Area and heading back into Los Angeles. Around this time period, Roman Polanski and his wife, Sharon Tate, were continuing to live their drug-fueled, jet-set lifestyle, with Polanski even being selected as one of the judges at the 1968 Cannes Film Festival, which would eventually be closed down due to various political movements taking place in France during this period. Polanski later said about this era of their lives together that Sharon's movie career was taking off much more quickly than his was. However, if you look at the reality of things, Sharon had starred or been a part of numerous movies which were derided and gutted by the mainstream Hollywood media, particularly her acting ability in these films. The reality is she was little more than a pretty face who was placed into these roles, so the idea that her acting career was really taking off is a bit of a misnomer. After leaving the Cannes Film Festival, to which they arrived in Polanski's Ferrari, they jet-set it around Europe for a bit, going to Rome, where both of them appeared in a documentary film, before going back to London, and then eventually heading back to Los Angeles. Upon arriving in Los Angeles, Sharon was honored with a Golden Globe Award for Best Newcomer for her appearance in Valley of the Dolls, which again was a box office bomb, and was also hired on to star in a Dean Martin Matt Helm spy spoof for which she was to be paid the sum of around $125,000. As well as being nominated for various other lesser awards that really matter to no one outside of Hollywood, including a Golden Laurel Award and being a runner-up in the Motion Picture Herald's poll for the Star of Tomorrow. One little interesting note from this period of time, this is from the official Sharon Tate website, is that she had dinner with Robert Kennedy on the evening of June 3rd, although this cannot be confirmed as actually having happened, as the Kennedys were known to have gotten into California extremely late in that evening. Sharon was a supporter of Robert Kennedy in his bid to win the presidency, and on the evening of the 4th and into the morning of the 5th, when Kennedy was assassinated by Sirhan Sirhan at the Ambassador Hotel, Roman and Sharon were supposed to be at a club to help celebrate in what they saw as his impending victory in the California Democratic primary, although this has not been confirmed. During this period of time, Roman and Sharon were renting Patty Duke's house, as Duke was in New York City to film Me, Natalie. The home was a large 9-bedroom affair in Benedict Canyon, Beverly Hills. It's interesting to note, just for the sake of noting it, that Patty Duke was the mother of Terry Melcher, who, if you'll remember, Melcher is the music producer that Brian Molson introduced Charles Manson and his family to, who lived in the house on Cielo Drive prior to Sharon and Roman moving into it. One interesting moment came after they took possession of Duke's home, where they decided to throw a party. What's interesting about this particular aspect is that part of the rental agreement was that they would take care of Patty Duke's dog, which escaped during the party and ran down the hill, only to encounter a pack of Alsatian dogs that were owned by the Process Church of the Final Judgment. For those who have not listened to other episodes of the Deathcast and may not be aware of the Process Church of the Final Judgment, they were a satanic group formed in England earlier in the decade of the 1960s. In fact, they were an offshoot of a Scientology group that was out there, who traveled to the United States, ended up in Mexico for a period of time before going on to Los Angeles, where they were patroned by a number of high-profile individuals. Manson even penned at least one article in their news magazine that they put out. And if you follow conspiracies of any type, they fit largely into a number of horrific crimes during the course of the 1960s into the 1970s. Their most prolific association was revealed by Maury Terry in his research on the Son of Sam killings. It was found by Terry that the cult that Berkowitz stated that he had been a member of was in fact a part of the Process Church of the Final Judgment. It is known that the Process Church kept Alsatian dogs. It is also known that they sacrificed these dogs, as well as German shepherds, around the area that Berkowitz was living in, with numerous bodies being found in an aqueduct that ran between the Carr home, which is where Sam Carr, who Berkowitz claimed he took the name Son of Sam from, and the apartment building that Berkowitz lived in. The bodies of these animals were also found in Untmeyer Park, where Berkowitz stated numerous rituals were formed. And this is all documented stuff. It's not made up, you know, conspiracy or conjecture. There is documentation to back all of this up, just as there is documentation to back up the fact that at this period of time, Polanski and Tate had a run-in with the Process Church. Polanski went down the hill to 1301 Summit Ridge Drive, which was the location of the Barrymore house of the Barrymore family fame, to try and retrieve Duke's dog, and ended up being chased by this pack of Alsatians. He ended up being cornered inside of a garage and was trapped there until he was able to break out a window inside the garage and escape out the back. While working on the film The Wrecking Crew, Sharon and Polanski continued to live in Patty Duke's home, with Polanski stating later that she really became the perfect homemaker, returning from working on the set all day and insisting on cooking for him and the cadre of individuals who were assembled at the house. On June 12th, 1968, Roman Polanski's film Rosemary's Baby came out, and this is really the film that launched him into international stardom, and his wife, Sharon, came along with him. This is really the apex of their relationship together. They became friends with both Peter Sellers and Mia Farrow, who began an affair at this period of time, with Farrow later talking at length about how eager Sharon was to please Roman. Again, we see Sharon basically wilting before a much more dominant personality. Around December 15th of 1968, Sharon Tate became pregnant through Roman Polanski. It was around this time in the early 1960s that stories began to circulate about Polanski and his rather strange sexual proclivities. Many of these center around the idea that he would often videotape himself and Sharon having sex, but also of Sharon having sex with other individuals, often against her will. One story that is particularly prominent is that Polanski forced Sharon to have sex with a number of African-American men on camera, and that he would show these films to friends at parties while Sharon, shamefaced, sat by quietly, unable to do anything over it. Whether or not these stories are true, they will play a part later on in the story, so there must be some veracity to them, I would believe. According to one of Sharon's friends, they went out of state for a few days, and upon returning, Sharon went into their bedroom in order to put her things away and discovered a number of reels of film on the bed. Upon inspecting these films, it was discovered that Polanski had filmed himself having sex with another woman in their marriage bed. According to this friend, this was just after Sharon found out that she was pregnant and that this nearly led to the end of their marriage. This was right around the time that the family had moved into the house on Cielo Drive, which Terry Melcher and his girlfriend Candace Bergen had just vacated. Now, according to this friend, now these are quotes from Ed Sanders' book, Sharon, A Life. They did a documentary on the last days of Sharon Tate in Paris by a production company called Sunset Press. Sunset Press sent a reporter and a producer-director to New York, where I lived in New York in 2005. She interviewed me, and she took a lot of film footage of me, showing my photos of Sharon Tate in the back of the interview scene, and they censored a lot of what I said to her. When asked why she was censored, this friend stated, "Because I think they didn't want to be too menacing to Roman Polanski, because Roman was what I said that Sharon told me about Roman, about imposed sexual scenes on her." Further on, this friend stated, "About Polanski, he was bringing other girls to have threesomes with Sharon, and Sharon didn't like it that he was picking up girls on the Sunset and bringing them home to have sex with them." This friend later stated that he had heard these insinuations from both Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring. This friend also recalled that Polanski was beyond angry over the fact that Sharon had become pregnant as a result of their marriage, and that he did not want to be a father. This flies in direct contradiction to the image that has always been pushed forth of Polanski being elated at the idea that he was going to be a father and have a family with Sharon. So we have all of this going on in their life. They left Doris Day's house. They're going to move into the house on Cielo Drive, which I jumped ahead and got to. One interesting piece of information is, in between Terry Melcher and Candace Bergen leaving the house on Cielo Drive and Sharon and Roman moving into it, an associate of the Manson family, the father of Ruth Ann Morehouse, Dean Morehouse, stayed in the home for a short period of time. During this period of time, Manson family member Tex Watson is known to have visited the house. And it is also known that during Melcher's stay in the house, that Manson himself is supposed to have visited it. I'm going to throw forth a theory at this point that others have put forth in the past, and I honestly believe to be the case. Melcher and Bergen left the house on Cielo Drive very abruptly in early January 1969. This was around the time that the relationship between Manson and Melcher is supposed to have begun souring. Candace Bergen has put forth that Melcher at this period of time was consumed over trying to unravel the financial affairs of his stepfather who had died the previous year, and that they in fact moved into his mother's beach home and that he would rarely return to the house before 10 p.m. following days of sitting in on meetings where they attempted to figure out exactly what the man had done with his finances. My theory is that more likely than not, during this period of time, Melcher's falling out with Manson was probably much uglier than has been reported, and despite the fact that some people have stated that Melcher was afraid of no man, I honestly believe that Melcher more likely than not was terrified of Charles Manson, and that because he had led the man on before, you know, ducking out on him and reneging on his promises, Melcher decided he needed to get out of the house as soon as possible because Manson and his followers knew where they lived, and Melcher feared that there might be some sort of reprisal, whether that was a violent reprisal or that, you know, something along the lines of Manson breaking into the house and stealing things. You have to remember that associates of Melcher had stated that he knew Manson had committed murders. Now, if this is the case, then it gives a lot of credibility to the idea that Melcher was terrified of him and would want to get away from the house knowing that Manson knew where he lived and that there was a possibility that Manson might come after him because of their deals which had fallen through. In any event, he moves and Candace move out of the house, and eventually Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski move into the house. There are a ton of stories out there involving Sharon and Roman's time in the home, and a lot of these center around other victims of the Tate murder scene. These involve Abigail Folger, Jay Sebring, Wojone Fajoyski, I believe that's how you pronounce his name, and the fact that the three of them were all supposedly involved in heavy narcotics trafficking, specifically Abigail Folger and her boyfriend. There is also speculation and some proof that points to Jay Sebring having been a distributor for the couple, using his hairstyling salons as a place where the drugs could be moved out of. We will get to that, though, when we really dig into the night of the murders and why everyone was at the house. Suffice to say, for the moment, I don't believe it was simply to, you know, keep Sharon company during the final stages of her pregnancy, which we are going to jump back into at this point. Around the period of time, early February of 1969, when the Tate-Polansky family moved into Cielo Drive, she finally let Roman know that she was pregnant, and he pushed for her to have an abortion.
From Ian Totten, best-selling author, The House of Silver Doors, The Blood Gods Trilogy, Maggie. A book which New York Times best-selling author Keith Elliott Greenberg has called a classic detective story, well-crafted, and a supernatural vortex. Maggie. The name was burned into Lieutenant Karo Jablonski's mind like a brand, and had been since the night of the fire. He doubted he would ever forget that night, or how she had danced in the flames of her burning home. Maggie, who was she, and why did no one in Kaya's Crossing seem interested in talking about her or her family? These were questions without answers. Quandaries that drove Carl on as he explored the darkest of the town's secrets, desperate to unravel the knots that tied everything together. Maggie, Carl felt haunted by a visage, even as the local reporter, George Murphy, told him of the blood-soaked history that lay along their path, and the horrors that it held. None of it seemed real, and yet it was. The sacrifices, the screams, the pact with the nameless ones, and the hell that she had endured. Maggie, hers was a crime begging to be solved, and he and George are the only ones with enough heart to do it. The real question is, will they survive long enough to do it? Maggie, available 11/30/2021 in paperback and hardcover. E-book pre-orders are now available at Amazon.com. Only from Corpse Creek Publishing. You have been warned.
Yes, I'm aware we are rehashing things that we have already discussed, but as I stated, I believe in the first episode, the timeline of things concerning both the Manson family as well as the Tate-Polansky family is very scattered-brained, and it is exceedingly difficult to find a very straightforward timeline of events. On the 15th of March, 1969, Sharon and Roman hosted a party at the Cielo Drive home, sort of a housewarming party, and during this party, friends of Wojtek Frykowski and Abigail Folger got into a fight. Of note here concerning Folger and Frykowski is that they had met the couple through Cass Elliott, who at this period of time was known to be heavily involved in drugs, and there is a lot of speculation and rumors that she was in fact pushing drugs from her home on Woodstock Road. At this party, an individual named Pick Dawson apparently stomped on Roman Polanski's agent's foot, after which some form of melee occurred, leading to Polansky throwing Dawson and his friends off of the property. According to the book Sharon, A Life, in the official homicide report from the murders, the events of this altercation are described and go on to state that the party was not, in fact, a housewarming party, but was instead a bon voyage party, as the Polanskis were going to Rio de Janeiro for a film festival. Afterwards, they were set to go to Europe, where Polanski was to direct a film. This is interesting to note, because when Roman and Sharon did leave the country, the three individuals who were involved in this altercation, William Doyle, Thomas Harrigan, and Harrison Pickford Dawson, were known to have been frequent guests at the house on Cielo Drive. I have read some accounts where Pick Dawson has been portrayed as a possible CIA or FBI asset. Again, this, if it were true, plays into what we talked about last week concerning Manson and his possible involvement in the CIA's MK-Ultra mind control experiments, as there is some speculation that Dawson had foreknowledge of the murders, or at the very least, knew that something was going to take place at that house on the night of the murders, and was also given knowledge after the fact concerning these crimes. According to a former NBC reporter who spoke to Ed Sanders for his book Sharon, A Life, Nancy Sinatra, who was an attendee at the party, was leaving. They encountered a group of long-haired hippies who asked them, quote-unquote, where's the party? And that Sinatra later wondered if what happened at the Cielo Drive house later on had not, in fact, been sown that night when she encountered the hippies, as she wondered whether or not it was in fact members of Manson's entourage that she had encountered. One story that came out years later came from Terry Melcher himself, a quote in the book Doris Day, Her Own Story. Melcher stated, "I knew they had been making a lot of homemade sadomasochistic porno movies there with quite a few recognizable Hollywood faces in them. The reason I knew was that I had gone out with a girl named Michelle Phillips, one of the mamas and the papas. Michelle told me she and John had dinner one night to discuss maybe getting back together, and afterwards he had taken her up to visit the Polanskis in my old house. Michelle said that when they arrived there, everyone in the house was busy filming an orgy and that Sharon Tate was part of it. That was just one of the stories I had heard about what went on in my former house." Should be noted that Michelle Phillips denied ever having told Melcher this, but it does feed into these stories that have floated around for decades, that there were some really unsavory things taking place in the Polanski marriage. It wasn't this beautiful, wonderful fairy tale that has been portrayed in the decades since the murders have taken place. And I know there's a lot of people who believe the current narrative of they had this beautiful, wonderful marriage, but enough people have come forward in the years since Sharon's death to refute this particular imagery that the old statement, where there's smoke, there's fire, it leads me to believe that while maybe not a bad marriage per se, there was a lot of debauchery, drug usage, and pressuring put on Sharon from Roman's end of things. That being said, I believe that she was a willing participant in a number of these acts, as that was Hollywood during this period of time, and in fact it's still Hollywood to this day. They're a very moralist society, and it's very possible that Manson and company did have interactions with the Polanskis at these orgies that they have. We know that Manson was prostituting members of the family during this period of time, and that he himself had his family take place in orgies. It's very probable that at some of these orgies, Hollywood individuals were involved, just as it's possible that at some of the Hollywood orgies to which Roman and Sharon were involved, members of Manson's family may have been participating. In any event, after going to Rio de Janeiro for the second International Film Festival, which took place on March 23rd to the 31st, Roman went to London to work on the film The Day of the Dolphin, which left Sharon unattended back in Los Angeles. I'm going to switch tracks here for a few moments to discuss Manson's known movements during this period of time. He spent the winter months of 1968 into 1969 out at a ranch Death Valley, located near Gore Wash. I believe this is more likely than not the Barker Ranch. After this, Manson was somehow able to rent a house at 21019 Gresham in Canoga Park, California, which is in the San Fernando Valley, not too far from Spa Ranch. The house was called the Yellow Submarine by members of his family. Describing the house in his autobiography, Manson stated, "Within 3 or 4 weeks of moving into the Yellow Submarine, it had become a concert hall for musicians, a porno studio for kinky producers, a dope pad, a thieves' lair, a place to dismantle stolen cars, and just about everything but a whorehouse." Manson attempted to keep some of the more illicit activities going on inside this particular home from Melcher and Dennis Wilson, who he still held out hopes were going to be forthcoming with a recording contract for himself and his girls. While living in this house, Manson held what was known as the Death Mock-Up Party, wherein members of the family who had recently returned to stay at the home took part in describing in great detail how they saw their own deaths happening in the hopes of actually experiencing the deaths without actually dying. Apparently, one individual who took part in this, by the name of Brooks Poston, actually sank into a trance that lasted for 4 or 5 days due to Manson commanding that he quote-unquote die. The coma was such that none of the individuals inside of the house could get the Brooks to come out of it, not even Manson himself. As the story goes, on the fifth day of this trance, Manson decided that his gray vest be placed beneath Brooks as a symbolic diaper. And upon hearing of what was to happen, Brooks threw himself from the trance and came awake. Also during this period of time, it is alleged in family lore that Manson was receiving fellatio from a young woman named Beau, who went into a frenzy during the act and nearly severed Manson's penis in two. And Manson, performing a miracle, was able to heal the injury and then began to pontificate to his followers, which stunned all of them as they had witnessed another miracle by Charlie. On March 23rd, Manson ended up going to the house on Cielo Drive looking for Terry Melcher. One of Sharon's friends answered the door, this individual later went on to state during the trial of Manson that he had no recollection of Charles coming to the house, and that this, in fact, was implanted in his mind by an investigator working on the case. This friend, during his testimony, stated that Manson came to the house looking for Terry Melcher and was directed to the guest house where Richard Antebelli was staying, and that while he was speaking to this man at the front door, Sharon Tate appeared and asked who was at the door. Being informed that it was no one, she went about her business. This has been used as the basis for the idea that Charles Manson specifically targeted Sharon Tate to be murdered as part of his supposed helter-skelter ideology. My own personal opinion is it's very probable that either Manson or one of his associates did visit the house during this period of time, and I honestly believe they may have visited it in subsequent periods before the murders took place, as the relationship with Melcher and Dennis Wilson continued to deteriorate. Now, there's every possibility that they were going there to score drugs from Frykowski and Abigail Folger. They may also have been providing others in the house with illicit substances. As the story goes, however, Manson, when he visited the house, learned that Sharon would be leaving the following day to go spend time with Roman in Europe. Again, this has never been verified, but Vincent Bugliosi put this forth as having factually occurred in an attempt to further implicate Manson in the premeditation of the murder of Sharon Tate. My personal opinion is that, yeah, Manson probably did go to the house, if not he himself, as I stated, members of his family. I highly doubt that during this period of time, though, Manson was looking to commit murders in order to A, start a race war, or B, inflict fear upon Terry Melcher. I honestly believe that he was really seeking to try and get this music career going and felt slighted by the fact that both Melcher and Wilson were distancing themselves from him. In any event, according to the official narrative, after meeting Sharon's friend at the front door, he went to the side of the house where Antebelli was, and upon introducing himself to Antebelli, was told that he, meaning Rudy, knew who Manson was, although he did not know where Terry Melcher was. At the trial, Greg Jacobson, who was a friend of Meltzer's, testified that during this period of time, Manson and the family were recording with Terry Melcher while living at the house on Gresham Street. According to Vincent Bugliosi at trial, Antebelli told him that during the flight the next day to Rome with Sharon, she asked him, "Did that creepy-looking guy come back there yesterday?" Well, Roman and Sharon were in Europe during this period of time is when Frykowski and Abigail Folger took up residence within the house on Cielo Drive. As previously discussed, there is a lot of evidence out there that they were involved in drug trafficking. And I really believe that during this period of time is more likely than not when other members of the family really got involved in knowing the layout of the house as well as who it was that was living there, as they more probably than not had interactions with the couple during this period of time. While in Rome, Sharon began production on a her final film role, which was titled The 13 Chairs, which was a satirical film. During this period of time, it is stated that Sharon repeatedly contacted her husband and asked him to join her, to which Polanski refused, stating that he was too busy while in London. There is some speculation from this period of time that because her husband was less than attentive, Sharon had an affair while she was filming The 13 Chairs with a man by the name of Christopher Jones. Supposedly, this also was fed by the fact that Polanski was less than faithful to his wife. Whether it's true or not, it would not surprise me, as this type of thing is extremely typical in Hollywood and celebrity circles. We are going to leave off the story here. From this point on, Sharon finishes the movie, goes to London to be with Roman, and eventually flies back to Los Angeles, where the remainder of our tale will take place. Next week, we will be getting into the final period of time of Sharon's murder, as well as further movements of the family, while hopefully diving into more on the actual murders themselves. Until next week, the Deathcast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing. Stay morbid.